Accession number 7480, rule number 3.
Mr. Jeffrey, rear 3. Yes, you were telling us about the ship was turned over.
The ship was turning over, gradually rolling over, and as we swam away from the ship, we all got in line, we all got together and we all started singing, like roll out the barrel and anything, or shouting to one another to keep up our spirits there, which I didn't find was too hard, really. I was determined I was going to get away, and I was certain I was going to do it. Anyway, we kept the other chaps going, and there were bodies floating about all over the place. I only saw one or two lifeboats. A lot of the Carly float, like, we didn't get away in time, because once she started rolling, we just had to leave it and take to the water and hope for the best. Well, we was in the part of the sea that we was in was off the Malayan coast, and as far as I can gather, it was one of the most shark infested seas in the world. But I did think when I was in the water just for a minute about it, but then I realised that all the bombs that had been dropped around us, there wouldn't be any sharks within miles of us there, so we didn't bother any more about those.
You knew that at that time?
Yeah, that the bombs exploding in the water, like, would drive the sharks away there, that it certainly wouldn't bring them to us. So we didn't bother any more about sharks, but just kept on swimming, resting a little bit, swimming again, until eventually I got picked up by one of the whaler off the Electra, one of the two destroyers that was with us at the time. But they came in after a time, because while I was swimming in the water there, probably I'd been in the water for at least an hour there, the Japanese was flying over us, very just above us, and one came ever so low and slowly there, and with its Addis lamp there, he flashed a signal to the destroyer, cease firing and pick up survivors. And so when they did that, the destroyer was able to drop boats over the side and pick some of us up. I got into the boat, pulled in the boat there, but by that time I got used to being in the water and it wasn't bothering me in the least. There I saw an EA electrical artificer, a friend of mine, floating by face downwards, and I saw a stoker PO like that. So I lowered myself over the side again, then swam out to them, pulled the EA to the boat, and then went back again for the stoker PO, which we got on board. But unfortunately, we didn't save either of them, because when we got them on board, there, none of us knew anything about artificial respiration. Had we have known something, we flopped their arms about and did, but that wasn't the right thing to do. And so, of course, they eventually died. It made us very upset. But anyway, during the time we was in the water, the Repulse rolled over onto its side, and all I could see was the starboard side sticking up, and men running all over the side of the ship there, and then it turned upside down, turned upside down, and it, a beautiful red bottom there, sticking up in the sea. Quite a sight if it hadn't been through the tragedy. And then eventually, the stern started sinking there, and during that period, there were men still clinging onto the hull instead of getting away. We could see them gradually going down with the ship, because once a ship starts to sink, like the suction of the ship, in any case, will take you down if you're anywhere near it, because the displacement of the water and that sort of thing and the air that comes out of the ship there. So anyway, we'd swim a bit more and then have another look to see what was happening there. And then at the last, I saw about from the cable locker to the end of the bows with the flag still flying there. She was vertical in the water, and there was even chaps clinging onto the flagpole and on the end of the bows there, but they didn't stand an earthly, because they got sucked down with the ship. And that was a sinking I just couldn't watch anymore. I felt very sad after that there, but still determined and still kept on swimming. And our little group like that, which you've seen in that paper there, we were still making it, and we still helped one another when we was in the water until we got on board this boat again. And then we were taken to the Electra, black as the ace of spades, all covered in oil fuel. eyes were smarting as the oil fuel had all got in her eyes. We'd taken a certain amount of it down on our stomach. When we got on board the destroyer, most of us started being sick, fetching up oil fuel and trying to get some water or something to wash our eyes out. By this time, there were quite a few men on board the Electra. And what happened to the other destroyer was, and that the other two, they went on board, they was alongside the Prince of Wales then, taking off the Prince of Wales there, but we just had to swim for it. We didn't get any help from, we just hadn't the amount of destroyers with us there, and it was just happened to be one of those things. We just didn't get no many lifeboats away, and I think I spent somewhere around about 3 or 4 hours by the time the action started till the time I was completely rescued. We stayed on the crew on board the Electra was very good. They all went round the lockers and seeing if they could find anything for us to wear. I managed to get hold of a piece of cloth and that, and I made myself a loincloth. By that time, I took all my oil fuel covered gear off and threw it into the sea. And there, and we just had light sort of loincloths on and anything we could be given. And we sat on the forecastle all through the remainder of the afternoon there with the ship heading towards Singapore, and all through the evening, right till the early hours of the morning when we arrived back at Singapore. The crew on board the Electra did everything they possibly could, and it was more or less impossible for them to have us down below deck, because we was that thick in oil fuel there, they would have never cleaned it up again, and they would have never been able to walk around. So we stayed on board the destroyer till the evening. We stayed into the dockyard, and when we got into the dockyard, they're tied up alongside, The gangplank was put down, and we walked down the gangplank, and by that time, having been up all that day, and all the day before, and all like that, and had very little to eat, only a few ration biscuits and that sort of thing, and of course we didn't want any after we got the oil fuel down, and we were that weak there, as we all were staggering and holding each other up, and they met us at the bottom of the gangplank, and the cruiser Exeter had prepared hot soup there, which they gave us a cupful each there, and hot rum, and we had that there, and then we were put into lorries and transferred to different parts of the Royal Naval Establishment. I forget the name of it. I think it was HMS Sultan. Well, I don't know. Anyway, I went to the Pierce Mess. There we were put under rot showers, and some of the oil fuel got on offers. There we couldn't get the oil fuel out of our eyes, not for days, really. And we kept being sick and fetching oil fuel up. And we were given a change of clothes, as we'd lost all our gear. And also I'd lost 7 weeks and my wages going out there. That all went down, which we never got back. We never reversed again. And I lost all my suits and all like that. And we only got eventually from the Navy just some old serge suits. We lost the doe skin and lost all the shirts and all like that. And we just had to make most of the things up ourselves. Anyway, we were glad to be alive. And let's see, where have I got to? It's an experience I'll never forget. Of course, you wouldn't be expected to anyway. But anyway, the Exeter looked after us, and then we went off to the naval base. We had a good scrub down, the best we could, and then wrapped up, and we all went to sleep in a corner somewhere. There, we were just dead beat. We couldn't stand up any longer. And coming round the next day, then we were given a pair of khaki shorts. I had a pair of khaki shorts, and a khaki shirt, a peak cap, and a pair of khaki gym shoes. That's all the clothing I had. And we later on in the day, we were given some money, a little money to spend, which I spent myself, going to the radio cablegram station on board, paying for a radiogram to be, telegram to be sent home to my parents, to say that I was one of the survivors, and it happened there. This telegram took so long to get home as about 5 months after I got back from Singapore one way or another there, on the same morning as I arrived home, and my parents during that time hadn't the slightest idea where I was. All they knew, they didn't know whether I was a survivor or not. They got this message to say that I was safe and would be coming home there. And the message and myself, we arrived on the same morning, which was most unusual. Yeah, and that's what's happened. But while we was at Singapore, after the second day or third day there, which we were resting up, I was sent for there, and I was told I was going to get I was going to have 40 ratings, 20 rounds of ammunition each, there a rifle and a bayonet, there and six either five or six Bofa guns in their packing cases there, and I was to go up and get them mounted and get them going. There now I'd never seen a Bofa gun in my life before. There, so what I had to do was there was walk up a railway, little railway track, and I found an army workshop. Luckily for me, I found a Bofa's gun, which had now been deserted there, as Singapore, the Japs was just over the causeway. So, of course, I managed to find a Bofa gun, manual, there, and read it, and get the lads to start unpacking the cases. We took them down to the where the 15-inch guns were on Singapore. Now, the irony of these guns were they were not the slightest bit of good, these 15-inch guns, because they would not train round over the Jaws Straits and over towards the Malayan coast, the Malayan side there. They would only point out to sea. They seemed to think, or whoever had put them down, that the invasion would come in from the sea, if they did. And they never thought about the Jaws Strait, so they couldn't train the turrets round. The mechanism would just not go round there. So the 15-inch guns was no good at all. Although we'd been sent with these Bofa guns and that sort of thing to defend them against air attack there. So what happened was, after unpacking the cases and that, getting all the parts out, we did work and we kept continuously going all the time. And the lads did very well indeed. And we got, we found out they had no sights. There was no sights in any of the spare boxes there. So what I had to do was work out an open sight, what we call like a grilled sight, like bars there. I went to this army camp there. There was all sorts of equipment in there, in the workshop there, and I had to make some sights to put on these Bofa guns, which I completed just after the dawn came down. And then the problem was assembling the guns and putting the mountings down, which we got down. We assembled the guns after I found a Royal Engineer or something to do with the army that knew a bit about it, and he told me the little snags about it, and we got the guns together. Then, of course, we mounted them on their pedestals and everything, and we just started training there when a lorry pulled up, and they said, "Is Ordnance Artificer Jeffries here? This is the last place we're going to look for him." And I overheard it, and I said, "Yes, here." He said, "Right, get your gear, if you've got any. There, put it in the back. You're going back to UK straight away, as you're wanted for these new battleships." And being as I'd been on these big ones, I was that started my journey back. I then got into the lorry there, rode to the port of Singapore. There was a 5,000 tonner alongside, and mostly officers and the families and that was all going on board, all white people, you know, being evacuated and that. And I got a billet on board there. I was going to share with another chap in the cabin, but there were so many women and children on board there, so we said, "Right, let them have our cabins and we'll go, we'll sleep on the deck," which we did. And we went from there, unmolested then, without any escort, there to Colombo in Ceylon there. From then, life became much better. Like, you know what I mean? We were getting proper meals again. There, we'd already changed white again instead of black. There, we didn't have a lot of clothing, but we did have some, and we had to go to the in Colombo. We had to go to the. We went to the army, and they put us on the Empress of Russia, a great big P&O liner, there, and with the Prince of Wales survivors, there, and then we went unprotected again. There we sailed through, and we sailed through. I don't know, it was a hurricane or something, anyway, where the ship was blown over at a terrific angle. It's there. But he eventually arrived at Durban on the southeast coast of Africa. From there, I went to the warrant officers and sergeant's mess at Clarewood Racecourse, which they'd put up. And I lived like a lord then. Everywhere people in Durban made us very welcome. We couldn't walk anywhere because everybody wanted to pick us up. One of my pals who was a survivor with me on the Ripoll, his relations lived in Durban, and of course they took us. They came and collected us in their car. And so every night while I was at this transportation, instead of sleeping in the mess, there I used to go and sleep at their place there. There'd be a nice warm bath and all nice food, and they treated us wonderfully well there. We was in the transportation camp for about a month, I think, there. And we had a real good rest. By that time, I'd started putting on weight, although I was 11 stone 2 when this action started there. By the time I weighed myself in Durban, I was down to 9 stone 2 there and suffering a lot. It hadn't hit me, not for the first week or so. But when I was coming across from Colombo on the liner there, I had a funny feeling that I wanted to jump over the side again. And sometimes I used to have to go and lock myself up in the cabin. It was nerves there, and I gradually got over that anyway, gradually beat that, and they had quite a nice time, but quiet time in Durban. There and the people, as I say, was very, very good to us. And then from there it came then that we were going to go back to UK from Durban, and we caught a 10,000 tara. And I don't know for sure whether it was, I think it was the Orduna there that we caught. And we sailed back to UK unprotected again, dodging the submarines there, but we got through. Luck would have it, we got through to UK, sailed up the Clyde, and I shall always remember it. There, the girls at a factory along the side of the Clyde, just as we got to the docks, there was all hanging out the window, all waving to us. We did look a pitiful sight because we hadn't a lot of clothing, and the funny thing. The coats that they issued us with at Durban, the raincoats, the first rainstorm that we had out there, all our other clothes were white underneath, all turned blue. The dye came out of the coat. Somebody had ripped us off. They had sold us a lot of stuff, which was no good. There, anyway, managed then, till I got back to the barracks, to the depot there, where we was refitted out again. And after that, I had 10 months ashore at a shore base there, going out on motor torpedoes and motor gunboats on trials during the daytime there, and at night, every time they went over London, they're climbing up onto a Martel tower to man a twin Lewis gun as Jerry swung over the top of us very low, but we never used to fire at him because we didn't want to give our position away. And that's eventually how I got back. There was one or two things that I did notice, and we was very disgruntled about, and that was we knew we'd been sent out by Winston Churchill to make a show, and we knew that it wasn't practical because they never experienced any ships being attacked by aircraft before there. And they didn't realise, or they couldn't have done, like most of it, we started running out of ammunition for a start. Well, you're a sitting duck in a ship unless you've got some air cover. You must have air cover to break up the formations as they come in, because they can come in from all directions. And there's a lot of directions, especially on a warship, on a battleship, there was a lot of gear hanging up above you on the masts and all sorts of things like that you can't shoot away, you wish you could, and you can't train your guns around there, and so often they come in where they could get out of the motor, which is quite easy. We're just sitting ducks there until it happened, till we rolled over.
Now, just now, why did you say you only had biscuits for 2-3 days?
Oh,
we were not fit.
Emergency rationing, like they, when you go into action, you see the cooks, even the cooks and everything like that, they're not cooking meals. They might be feeding the ammunition oyster or something like that. They all look. Or first aid, helping the first aid parties and that. All that sort of thing, cooking and all like that, all stops when the ship goes into action anyway. Mm-hmm. Yes, action stations. Mm-hmm. You see, like the band, we used to have a marine band on board. Well, they used to work the fire control tables, setting the instruments and things during action stations. Different people like, they're all busy in, defending the ship, not firefighting parties and all sorts of things.
So did you have any sleep during that voyage?
No, not very little sleep. I remember once curling up in a corner on a coat. There, I was that dead tired, I couldn't keep my eyes open. There, while it was quiet, there, but not during the action itself, because we was far too busy. We didn't even notice the time slipping by. It went by very quickly for saying, because I didn't realise the action alone took an hour and a half. There, well, you sit down for an hour and a half, and it's quite a good time. But when you're busy, and really busy, because you know your life is at stake,